Good morning and welcome to Neocani View. I'm Peter Newman, and our guest this morning is a gentleman who, there's so many things to talk about with Micah White. First, I'll say welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You are the person who is credited, and this just strikes me as a phenomenal concept, that you are credited with the phrase Occupy Wall Street. We'll get to that, but then that suggests your range and how important your work is. But before we do that, how have you made it to the Oregon coast? I don't mean how, but why?
Well, I think that the Oregon coast, and actually the larger Cascadia that we're part of, this bioregion that we're part of, it plays a really important role in the political destiny of the American democracy. And so I think that after Occupy Wall Street, a lot of the founding activists, and there's, as everyone knows, as they're part of Occupy, there's founders all over the country. The movement kind of was such a event that a lot of us really reevaluated our lives and changed and took new directions. And my wife and I, we looked at our lives and we said, let's move to some place that is so beautiful that will unlock our creativity. And we had been to this place, we'd been to Neocani 10 years ago, and we remembered how beautiful it was, so we picked it. And since moving here, though, it's opened my eyes to a new layer of politics, which I am starting to think about, which is the rural politics of America.
I saw that on your website, referring to rural politics, and maybe we can just start there, because your argument is, I think, in part, that there's a whole chunk of rural America that's kind of been left behind in the debate.
Exactly. I'm coming at it from the perspective of an activist. So for me, I was always raised in the tradition of an urban protest, an urban activism, which means that if you want to make political change, they tell you get as many people as possible into the streets, rally and march. But that kind of activism doesn't actually make sense in a rural environment where there's fewer people. What are you going to protest? The mom and pop shop on the street? No, it doesn't make any sense. And so what I started to see is, well, if there's no reason to do protesting in that way, like, what is it about the rural areas that how do you politically engage with the rural areas? And for me, it's a realization that the rural areas have been completely neglected by the federal, urban-centric U.S. government.
Basically. But it is partially a matter of numbers. Of course, more people, by definition, live in urban areas than in rural. So how do you organize when people are spread out that much? I mean, there's a reason why it's Occupy Wall Street. It's because that's a very dense, powerful area of the country and the world.
Yeah. Well, I think it's also about a change of perspective. The rural areas of our country are actually the resource-rich areas. So they're, in a way, the richest areas. And as this kind of impending ecological catastrophe grows in strength, it's actually going to be these are going to be the power places for the climate refugees who are going to be fleeing the lack of water and stuff like that. So actually what's happening is that we live in the most valuable and the most desirable bioregion in America. It's called Cascadia, and it extends into Canada as well. And so it's actually kind of a change of mindset for me. It's realizing that this is the most precious part. And the urban areas, I don't think, are able to really see that because of what you're saying. There's so many people. It's easy to get lost in that buzz of activity.
There was the book of a few years ago, What's Wrong with Kansas? And the boil down to the essence, it's people not acting or voting or participating in their best interest. And it seems to me that is a charge which at least as often is applied to rural areas.
Hmm.
Am I wrong about that? It seems to me that to the extent that rural areas, some of them anyway, maybe not specifically around here, tend to be more conservative, that to use the thesis of What's Wrong with Kansas, that people in rural areas tend not to be as socially or as politically engaged in wider issues. I mean, the liberal centers, let's put it that way, tend to be urban.
Yeah. Well, I think that for me, I'm not really interested so I think that the important thing to realize is that, let's say we live in a situation where we are trying to change political reality, right? Everyone wants a way to kind of change the social political reality of America, and they don't know how to do that. They think, with Occupy Wall Street, we thought that you could mobilize, if you were able to get the vast majority of Americans to agree on a centralized message, and if you're able to articulate that in the streets, that then elected representatives would have to somehow listen to you and do what you wanted. That was kind of the argument behind most social change theory. And so for me, it's not a question of like whether or not the people who live in rural areas are exemplifying the political activity as defined by a kind of, you know, urban-centric idea of social change. Instead, it's about trying to understand how a non-urban mindset might provide some of the answers that we're seeking in America about democracy. Because I think that when you live in a small towns, it, like one of the things that's beautiful about living in Nehalem is that there's one of everything. It's a tiny microcosm of the larger world that we live in. You know, there's a saying in alchemy that I think is really beautiful. It says, as below, as above. And it basically means that, you know, if you look at the small how things work on a microcosmic level, well, maybe that reveals how they work on a macrocosmic level. And I think that's part of the beauty of rural areas. If you can make the rural areas, if you can make places like Nehalem, Manzanita, and Wheeler the best possible place on earth to live, then you can replicate that and grow it into these other things. So I think it's that it's about trying to kind of revive politics from a rural centric perspective.
Our guest this morning on Neocon View is Micah White, who will be holding a Nehalem workshop. We'll get to talk about the workshop shortly, but I wanted to jump back to Occupy Wall Street and just the Occupy movement. When it first hit, there was a great deal of excitement. It literally was on so many people's lips. And then what? It seems to me that, please correct me if I'm wrong, the air went out of the balloon.
No, that's not what happened. What happened is that from my perspective, what's really interesting, so I'll just briefly define my role in the movement, which I think is kind of strange. So my role in the movement is I was working at a magazine called Adbusters, and the editor and I, his name is Cullen Lassen, we created the idea of Occupy Wall Street, basically with those words. And it was this idea, like, let's go to Wall Street, let's set up an encampment. At that time, there was all these, you know, revolutions happening in Spain and Egypt, and we basically combined those two together and said, let's go to Wall Street and let's get money out of politics. Now, what's different, however, is that social media allows ideas to grow so virally and so exponentially quickly that it exceeds human capacity to even understand it. For the first time in human history, Occupy Wall Street was growing faster than you could even understand. I remember there's a 24-hour time period when there was more encampments than you could conceive of. It basically went from being in a few cities to being in every city. And so it had an exponential viral peak that is higher than anything we've ever seen before, right? And then that is because the state and the governments didn't know how to respond. It always takes a little bit of time for the status quo to respond to an emerging threat, which Occupy was. But once they figured out how to respond and how to shut down the encampments, which happened around November 15th in New York City, almost all the encampments were shut down across America and the world within about a month, right? And that really marked the moment that our movement was defeated.
So you would say it was defeated
exactly.
At that point.
Exactly. Unlike the 70s, where you had a situation where the activists had kind of a prolonged, long burnout, where they kind of went from mass movement down all the way into the 70s with these Red Brigade, urban terrorists, you know, kind of like the decay of the left. With Occupy, it's actually beneficial that we went the other direction, which is we went out into the encampments, we had a constructive failure, that's what I call it, we learned something in failing, and we went home. And then we kind of regrouped, some of us moved to Nehalem, others you know, had babies, got married, and now we're coming back for 2014. We're not as burned out, you know?
And yet you can have a story like over the last year, the NSA story, in which frankly, though there's a lot of concern on the number of people, by a lot of people in this country, it has, at least from a social activist point of view, there's sort of a shrug, and you can get 700,000 people to turn out for a team that wins the Super Bowl.
Well, I mean, you have to look at it like this. The way I look at it is basically that all around the world, the 99% is suffering, right? We can all agree with that, basically. The earth is dying, so there's less natural resources. There's climate refugees. People are suffering. And so they're looking for ways to change the situation for the better. They're trying to protest and rise up. And they fall back upon tactics and techniques that have been taught to them from the society at large. So if you're told, if you believe in your heart you need to change society, well, society tells you there's a couple avenues. You can have a mass movement, right? Here's what it looks like. It's from the 70s. I was raised on all those images. Here's these other ways. And what I'm saying is that none of those ways are true. None of those ways actually work. And so when the people understand that in their hearts, like I think people do right now, then they stay home. But the moment you create a tactic, that lets them believe that if they follow through on this, that things will change. They'll be right back out into the streets.
You're a very wired individual. When you say out into the streets, there's a sort of, metaphorically, there's the electronic streets, which did not exist a generation ago.
Yeah, totally. And I think that the objectives are so much different. Like when I talk about get out into the streets, it is totally metaphorical because as we learned with Occupy Wall Street, well, the political transformation that we're looking for is going to involve some sort of action on the streets, but it can't only involve action on the streets. That's why electoral strategy is so crucial right now, because you have to, one of the things I think about as an activist, it's the most demanding, basically, profession, because every great tactic only works one time. As soon, you can't, like, I'll say this to all the Occupy people out there again. We probably will never be able to occupy in exactly the same way ever again. No one in history may ever be able to. You can see that with the use of barricades in 1848. The use of barricades was overwhelmingly successful in 1848, but then it became less and less successful until finally the Paris Commune, and it was proved completely ineffective to set up barricades in an urban environment like Paris. So barricade use still persists. People think about, you know, to kind of get to the barricades. And the same way Occupy encampments might persist in our imaginary, but the next great tactic will be something that really inspires us to get out there.
I sense you're an optimist.
Absolutely. Totally an optimist, yeah.
Well, you know, I look at, for example, the way congressional districts are drawn,
yeah.
Which make pretty much safe seats for both parties. That does not make me optimistic.
Yes, but you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And so the beautiful thing about Occupy Wall Street is that it was an idea that captured people's imagination, and then they did it of their own volition. I didn't have to, or no Occupy person was out there telling people what to do. Instead, we demonstrated through our own actions replicatable things that they could do in their communities. So then they were able to do that in their local communities. And so I'm an optimist because I see that right now, because of the internet, ideas can spread so quickly. It is now possible to come out of nowhere. I believe this. To come out of nowhere and win an overwhelming majority in the U.S. election with only 3 months lead time. I really believe that if you had your stuff together, maybe not in 2014, maybe in 2016, but I really believe that if we can get a social movement together, it can do that. And that's the beauty.
Well, you know, if it comes to things like drug policy or gender equality or gay rights, those things, the pace of change with a number of issues right now, it just startles everybody. And I think we're all trying to make sense of it. How did this paradigm shift happen so quickly? Is that part of what you're saying?
Absolutely. What I'm trying to explain is that we're going through a period of sustained social change on all fronts, right? So you can just like, I know that I'm, you know, Occupy Wall Street, you think about financial. Let's cut out the financial. Let's just think about some of the other areas. Like you mentioned, like gay rights and all of these other, across the spectrum, we're going through a period where people are reevaluating and allowing things that they took for granted to be changed. And I think that that's because of three reasons. One, the dying environment. We're living as social organisms and humans, as a species, we're living under a situation where the earth is kind of dying around us, and that puts a pressure on us psychically. Number two, the collapse of global capitalism. The financiers who own the democracies around the world and have this global capitalist, you know, slush fund that they circulate around the world are basically incapable of finding a solution, and we all know that if we listen to them forever, they're going to destroy us. And then the third is basically the spiritual crisis of the West. We live in a society that's been so focused around consumerism for so many years, we don't actually have a deep sense of meaning, right? And when a civilization loses its sense of meaning, then it enters a period of decline. And so I think that we are in this period of both decline and promise. You know, we're entering a multipolar world. In that multipolar world, it's not going to be just nation states anymore. It's going to be people's movements. It's going to be viral social movements who have a say. And that we're seeing that right now in Italy and in Spain, where the third largest political party in Italy is a social movement.
Our guest this morning on the Econi View is Micah White. Micah, and yet we also have the Supreme Court case Citizens United, which is all about the money. And I think I might hear you saying that, well, it may be all about the money, but money may not be what turns it in the future.
I think that's absolutely right. My theory is that, like, the internet gives, it's a force multiplier. Let's put it that way, right? If you are in a fight and you have a gun, it's a force multiplier because you can be much further away from your enemy and you can shoot at them. Well, the internet is also kind of force multiplier. It allows you to distribute memes and ideas all around the world that convince people to rise up, and you don't have to be in that place. No one really knows. What I'm trying to get at is no one really knows the profound way that the internet is going to change the nature and distribution of power politics right now. We think that it's going to benefit people like nation states, like the NSA, who has a tremendous amount of data, and they think that's going to help them. But my theory is that actually these viral social rituals, which is what social movements are, basically the transmission of social rituals that we do together, the possibility of that is more powerful than what they have in store. Because it requires a level of authenticity. What Occupy had was total authenticity. We were not an AstroTurf movement. We were not receiving outside funding. We were literally just a movement of each other, communities, neighbors. That literally is the truth. And they don't have authenticity on their side. Money doesn't give you authenticity. Authenticity is immaterial. And so the movement that has the authenticity, like we're seeing in Spain, will be the one who has power.
But you also, there's authenticity. There's also consolidation within the internet community of, you know, who's controlling the pipelines and you know, access and you know, how much bandwidth you can throw to one particular interest versus another. In internet neutrality, there's a thumb on the other side of the scale too.
Absolutely. And that's why it's an interesting dance. Like throughout history, you can see the same thing. There's always been a dance between the cat and the mouse. There's always been a dance between people and their governments, between the king and the people. But throughout history, we have seen that the people will suddenly win for brief periods of time. And sometimes those periods aren't so brief. You know, the French Revolution actually lasted a long time. And even in 1848, with the barricades, they were able to topple a king. So I think that what we saw with Occupy may have been impressive in our eyes, but actually in terms of the metric of social movements, we haven't seen anything yet. Like 1848, they literally toppled kings. Like, whereas in Occupy, we just kind of saw how it's possible to activate our citizen network.
I want to talk about your workshop. You've got a workshop coming up March 13. What are the goals and what can people expect? And how can we participate locally?
Okay, so March 13, I'm giving a workshop in Nehalem. It's called the Nehalem Workshop Foundations. It's going to be, first of all, there's a 75% discount for all Nehalem, Wheeler, and Manzanita residents. And what we're going to talk about is I want to start a series of workshops and I am starting a series of workshops for activists to kind of reevaluate the theories of social change that we have. I think that basically all theories of social change right now are in flux, and that our job as activists is to kind of evaluate, well, why do we think that the things that we do is the correct way to change political structures? In the workshop specifically, one of the things I'm really thinking about lately is the rise of Christianity. I think the rise of Christianity is a really important thing for activists to think about. Now, I started as an atheist activist, and so I've had a newfound appreciation of the history of Christianity because it's quite beautiful. You have a movement that was a social movement that was illegal. It was the only religion in the Roman Empire that was illegal. It was the first religion ever to be outlawed. And for about 300 years, it was under persecution. For the last 50 of those, you could be killed just for being a Christian. Now, Christianity is now the dominant religion, or one of the dominant religions. How? It's because one person, Constantine the Great, had a conversion. He converted to Christianity before a significant battle. He said that that was because he saw a vision of Jesus Christ, and that there was a celestial cross in the sky. His whole army saw it, apparently, too. And that's why Christianity wins. They didn't win through protest. So what does that mean about social change? I want to basically think about what different ways of approaching social change theory and kind of reviving the local activist community.
So can we pick a local issue that of your choosing that people might focus on and see where we can go with that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that I'm trying to do is basically, I think of it as terms of innovation trainings. So I think when you think innovatively about activism as a social change, it can be applied to any local cause. So there's going to be an opportunity. So the workshop is basically, I'll give a kind of presentation in the beginning, then we'll have a small group discussions where we can talk about various things, and then the group will be able to have an opportunity to then ask me questions. So we can talk about local issues, local activist campaigns, and we can brainstorm together, are there new ways we can approach this and stuff like that. And then we'll all have lunch together, and it'll be a nice kind of first initial brainstorming about this. But definitely, I think that the lessons of Occupy Wall Street can be applied to all kinds of social change campaigns.
How do we talk to each other? By that, I mean, so much of the dialogue in this country, political dialogue, social dialogue, religious dialogue, dialogue period, is we're talking past each other.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a different way of framing a discussion that can bring another side over to at least an appreciation of your point of view?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that, you know, Occupy is trying to be a movement of the 99%. And that's not just, and that the 99% doesn't just live in America, right? We're not 99% of the world. So to actually think of a movement of the 99%, I think for me, I've been really lately inspired by, and this is going to sound strange, but basically like pagan thinking. One of the things that's amazing about the Roman Empire is that they had so many different religions, aside from the persecution of the Christians, which came later. Basically, they didn't force any one idea. So I think what I'm saying is we have to enter into a political reality where you allow political difference. That's the only way to proceed, because we have to, it's, you know, the challenge right now for humanity is to solve global political problems. It's the people must start to provide solutions to global political problems like climate change and the collapse of global capitalism. In order to do that, we have to be able to build a coalition of the people. I like to think of it as a league of the people that allows completely different political ideologies to kind of work together. I mean, that's just...
It has struck me over the last few years that the Tea Party movement, for example, mm-hmm. could have been a left-wing movement.
Yeah.
It wasn't.
Right.
And it seems to me that the left made a serious error in not seeing what was underneath the Tea Party movement and working with the concepts, if not some of the fringe racist elements of it, to use one example, that underlying the Tea Party movement, there's a commonality between what we traditionally think of as left and right.
Absolutely, absolutely. What's happening for me, in my eyes, is that the distinction between left and right is really dissolving.
Old thinking?
It is old thinking. And the most important thing is the birth of populism. Populism is not left nor right. Populism is about supporting the people, making sure that the life of average people who are, whose only, basically, the only requirement for kindness is that someone is a human or alive. That's the political world that we should be living in. It shouldn't be such that if you can't make money in the current economy, you're just thrown onto the street. That's horrible, right? We live in a society that's kind of horrible to each other. And so, like, I think that the left and the right thinking is important. What's important is populism. Do you support average people? Do you want to make the life of average people better? Or are you someone who's just greedy, who wants to make yourself rich, you know, who wants to get to the top 1% and screw everything else? That's really, to me, the defining thing right now. And I think even people in the top 1%, most of them are on the side of the 99%. They're not rich because they hate everyone. They're rich for some other reason. They came up with a great idea. They're innovative thinkers or whatever. And they're actually on the side of the 99%. The people who are not on the side of the 99% is a tiny, 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 but powerful, powerful group of people who are also have a strong ideology because they own the media. So we hear their voices very frequently. But if we counted them up, there'd be like 1,000 or 2,000 people who you could actually say, like, now these people really hate humanity. And really, you know what I mean? Like,
but that's a pretty powerful bunch of people. Look at the recent book on Karl Rove, mm-hmm. and the rise of Fox News being essentially an arm of a political party.
Yeah.
That is an enormous megaphone.
Yeah, and you have the same problem around the world. The thing to remember is that the problems we face are being faced by other people around the world. So in Italy, for example, well, there you go. Berlusconi also owns the media, and he was in power for so many years. They're just finally trying to get rid of him now. It's the same... Canada, Conrad Black, right? So like the same thing happens around the world, and the people are divided, right? So so we're basically fighting a united enemy, and we're divided. And so it's very important that we, like you're saying about the Tea Party, and Occupy in the future are going to be understood largely as the same manifestation of the people's mm-hmm. desire to change things, and so that's kind of the direction we're heading.
Can you take this world of optimism to the Middle East?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about the Middle East is that it's like, it is, I mean, what I think it's all about is setting these huge tasks for ourselves. So one of the huge tasks is solving climate change. But another one of the huge tasks is restoring the Holy Land, right? This is one of these tasks that you can mobilize people about. So I think it is about seeing ourselves as part of a long universal story, human story, that does, as you're alluding to, stretch back to Christianity, the Judaism, the Holy Lands. Humanity has to kind of like finish that story. That's part of what's keeping us on edge, right? Is like, what is the end of the story for us? We don't know.
But you're earlier talking your admiration, justifiably so, of Christianity. Yeah. There's a lot to be admiring of many religions. And then you drill down to the ground where people are actually fighting over in some cases, minutiae of doctrine. And mm-hmm. To those of us who may not be party to the doctrine, we're going, what is this all about?
Yeah, totally.
It doesn't make sense to us, and it's a deeply held belief for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the, like, actually the defining moments of my life is I was a sophomore in college when the World Trade Center attack happened, you know, so I watched that live on television. And I realized in that moment that I was just a normal American. I'm raised by lower middle class people, and I had never been outside of America. And I realized that when someone was attacking the World Trade Center, doing the most spectacular act of terrorism and horrific cruelty that anyone's ever seen before on television, basically, is a horrible thing. And I didn't understand why. Why are they doing that, right? So I dropped out of college and I went to the Middle East. And I volunteered. I spent 6 weeks traveling by myself in Jordan, and then I spent 6 weeks traveling by myself in Palestine with this group called the International Solidarity Movement. And the International Solidarity Movement is a nonviolent direct action movement where you live with Palestinian families. So I really got to see the conflict, the Israel-Palestine conflict, from the ground level. You know, and one of the things that I saw there is that it is definitely a complicated and horrific conflict, but it is also one that is being perpetrated right now and allowed to continue, despite the fact that most people in the world are now on the side of ending it justly. I think there's a lot of will. Where in the 70s, the left actually was in favor of Israel, and I think that right now in this historical moment, most of the world is against Israel's treatment and occupation of Palestine, and that an opening is happening.
Well, it's interesting. You look at Syria, for example, which is getting to look a little bit like a proxy war with Russia on one side and Western powers on the other. Shades of the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, it's the breakdown of America as a superpower and the rise of a multipolar world. So we're seeing nation states vie, but we're also seeing social movements. Al-Qaeda is also kind of a social movement, right? They have a recruitment structure, they have an ideology, they have iconography. And so we're seeing a social movement vie against nation states in these breakdown areas. So it's all part of this larger realm of social change that we're going through.
We could be talking about this with great pleasure for the next several hours, I think. But first of all, I would urge our listeners to go to your website, Micah, that's M-I-C-A-H-M. White.com, and also get in on the workshop. Once more again, where and how to get information on it.
It's March 13th in Nehalem, and the location is a surprise, which will be announced. It's going to be an awesome location, though. You're going to want to be there.
And your website has just a number of fascinating articles and points of departure. I mean, we've just kind of hopped around these in a very superficial way, but I just really think, again, it's MicahMWhite.com, MicahMWhite.com, and it will be a fascinating place to just park yourself for many an hour and just go through the links, go through your there's great video and audio on you. We're honored to have you in our community. Thank you.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And that's our guest this morning on The Econie View is Micah White. Thank you again for joining us, and join us again next month for another edition of The Econie View.